not just a mere technicality. Accept disqualified. This is a tax update for May 26, 2008. The Tax Update podcast intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research and confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and the supporting document may be reproduced freely as long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the audio file. Such prohibited use include using the podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information for tax practitioners to subscribe to their services. Visit them on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Well, this week I'm going to be recording and hopefully getting a couple of podcasts ready, although we'll release them hopefully on the weekly schedule, since I'm getting ready for some travels coming up here shortly. And I also this week obtained, to help me in my travels a bit, a new EPC. That's an Asus model. It's about a 7-inch screen, tiny little thing. Advantage being that it's very useful on aircraft and airplane, even when the person in front of you decides on a cross-country flight they're planning to recline their seat, something that causes some issues even with a 13-inch notebook like the MacBook I normally use to record this podcast on. So I've been working with the EPC, and for anybody thinking of getting one or have seen one and thought about them and looks at that tiny keyboard, the keyboard actually seems to be more workable and usable than I thought it was. In fact, I worked up this week's materials on the EPC just to make sure I could actually work with the thing. And this week's materials are going to be worked up on a case that came down this week involving a SEP, an S corporation, and a pair of spouses. Now, if you subscribe to Lineberg Services, you probably have already seen a write-up of this by Steve Lineberg and Barry Picker that discussed this particular case, which is interesting, and I think it's interesting to be discussed as well, related to the very, very tight rules that the court applied and the willingness of the court to disqualify a SEP in this case where the taxpayer didn't follow the rules, dot the I's and cross the T's. Now, a simplified employee pension or a SEP are a fairly popular retirement program for small, closely held entities, especially where the owner or the owner and their closely related family members are the only employees of the entity. A significant reason for the attraction for such plans is the fact that business owners see them as lower cost alternatives to full-blown qualified plans, since there's no need to maintain a separate plan trust, and most often no third-party administrator is brought in to handle the plan, therefore no payments made to a third-party administrator. However, that also tends to mean that such plans are run in a rather sloppy fashion. This week, we're going to take a look at a case where an error that some might have characterized as a no harm, no foul situation should have resulted in an adjustment, in fact, a disqualification of the plan rather than no adjustment. The tax court was not inclined to accept the rule that this was no harm, no foul, and disqualified the plan in its entirety. And that result should raise concern for taxpayers who have such plans, for advisors associated with clients with such plans that are not obtaining outside advice on the operation of the plan. The advisor in that case may very well find the client believes that that particular advisor whom they were looking at for other tax advice, be that their CPA, EA, or attorney, is going to take care of advising them of the issues related to the SEP plan, something that the advisor may not think they're doing, but they may find themselves being the only advisor left in the room when things go wrong. The case involved is a case of Brown versus Commissioner, Tax Court Summary Opinion 2008-56, and that involved Mr. and Mrs. Brown, their S corporation, and a SEP. The problem occurred when, despite the fact that both Mr. and Mrs. Browns were employees of the S Corporation, SEP contributions were made solely on behalf of Mr. Brown. The failure to comply with the terms of the plan that required contributions on behalf of all eligible employees doomed the deduction in the eyes of the tax court, even though the only person discriminated against was the spouse of the owner of the S Corporation. Now, let's take a look at the overall design of SEPs here, and especially the provisions involved in the code for SEPs that are going to come into play in this particular case. The SEPs were created to give small businesses a less complex retirement plan that could be implemented without the complexity and cost of a full-blown standard qualified plan and trust under Section 401A. The plan uses IRA accounts created in the names of the participant in the plan to hold the plan's contribution, eliminating the need to maintain a tax-exempt employee benefit trust. Since the accounts are fully in control of the employee once the contributions are made, there's no need to file annual reports traditionally made on Form 5500 for qualified plans to report the activities of that trust. Nor does the plan account to the participant for the activities in their account. Rather, the employee simply obtains the statements they normally get from the custodian of their IRA account. It's their IRA account. As you might expect, though, not all is rosy for a SEP. The SEPs are simple. That simplicity does lead to a few significant disadvantages to them. First, all contributions are fully vested in the employee once a contribution is made. We're making the contribution to the employee's IRA account. That's their IRA account. They could take the money out the next day and spend it on whatever they wish. Now, of course, they'll pay tax if they do that and penalties, but the employer has no control. And if the employee leaves after getting the first contribution, none of that reverts back or can be used against future contribution or allocated back to other participants. In a SEP, it is 100% vested from day one. Coverage rules do not allow for an exclusion of employees based on hours of service. Rather, we have to cover anybody who receives over a rather minimal amount, dollar amount of earnings in 3 of the previous 5 years. And the options for allocating an employer contribution are fairly limited. Basically, it goes on compensation, with the only potential way to skew that contribution up to a different direction is based upon the limited options available for permitted disparity under the plan rules. And even that only exists if the plan allows for it, as always. Now, the participation rules for a SEP plan are spelled out in Section 408K2, which provides the following. In that case, the participation is satisfied with respect to a Simplify employee pension for a year only if for such year the employer contributes to the Simplify employee pension of each employee who has obtained age 21, has performed service for the employer for during at least 3 of the immediately preceding 5 years, and received at least $450 in compensation within the meaning of Section 414Q4 from the employer for the year. And for the purposes of this paragraph, that goes on to note there shall be excluded from consideration employees described in paragraphs A and C of Section 410B3. And for purpose of any arrangement described in K6, any employer who is eligible to have an employer contribution made on the employee's behalf for such arrangement shall be treated as such a contribution was made. Now, a couple of the descriptions of those cross-references. First thing is, when you have the cross-reference there to 410B3, that's a cross-reference essentially to those covered by collective bargaining agreements, as well as those particular ones covered in who are non-resident aliens. The K6 reference deal is to a variant of the SEP that you may rarely run into these days called the SAR SEP. Ever since the Simples came in back in 1997, the SAR SEP was removed from the law. Old SAR SEPs are continued to operate, but no one sets up a new one. As a practical matter, given some of the difficulties from a practical standpoint of running a SAR SEP, it had a lot of issues, and there was only once in my career we ever had a client set one up, and that client was not terribly happy after they saw the mess they got involved in trying to keep it running. But there were a number of quirks with those plans. They could not be set up after 97, and you're rarely going to see one today. Rather, the Simple took over for that, and probably from a more practical standpoint, the Safe Harbor 401k eventually displaced most of the Simples, except in the very, very small business context. Now, allocations to a SEP are governed by 408k3, which provides a similarly restricted set of requirements. Basically, contributions cannot discriminate in favor of the highly compensated, etc. In general, the requirements of this paragraph are met with respect to a SEP for a year if, for such year, contributions made by the employer to the SEP for the employees do not discriminate in favor of any highly compensated employee within the meaning of 414Q. And we again get to exclude under B those same two pair of type of employees we talked about before, those covered by collective bargaining arrangements and those who are non-resident aliens. And for purposes of subparagraphs A, except as provided in D, we always love these cross-references, employer contributions to SEPs, other than contributions under the SAR SEP we talked about earlier that really we're not going to see much anymore, shall be considered discriminatory unless contributions thereto bear a uniform relationship to the compensation not in excess of the first $200,000 of each employee maintaining a simplified pension. Now, note, the 200 and the 450 numbers we've talked about are both indexed for inflation. Those numbers move up each year. We're not going to worry too much about the details at this point of the limitations because we're talking about a slightly different issue here about how to file one up. Permitted disparity is provided in D. Remember, that was one of the exceptions where you don't have to be uniform. And that provides that for the purposes of section, for purposes of subparagraph C, the rules of section 401L2 shall apply to contributions to simplified employee pensions. What that means is we are allowed to have permitted disparity or what used to be referred to as Social Security integration in a SEP, but the plan has to provide for permitted disparity. As a practical matter, the standard SEP documents you can find on the IRS website doesn't have a provision for permitted disparity. And so in order to have permitted disparity one, you're going to have to adopt a different plan other than the standard one found on the IRS website. Now let's go on and talk about the details of the Brown case. As we noted, Mr. Brown owned an S corporation, Aaron Brown Mortgage, Inc., and both he and Mrs. Brown were employees of the corporation for the years in question. On October 1st of 2001, the corporation established a SEP, a Simplified Employee Pension Plan, by executing a Form 5805 SEP with the Vanguard Group. Now, note, as mentioned, a SEP does not have to be obtained from the financial institution. The IRS posts a SEP plan on its website, Form 5805 SEP, that employers can execute independently of any specific institution. Now, that form offers only vanilla options. No permitted disparity provision is in that plan, though it does not restrict funding to a particular IRS custodian. However, Mr. Brown elected to use the plan available directly from Vanguard in their packet, which, in fact, is just the standard IRS form if you get it from the Vanguard website, at least the ones I've seen recently. I'm going to presume Mr. Brown executed a very similar one. Certainly, the form in question, 5805 SEP from the IRS, would contain the provisions that we're going to talk about in this case. Now, he did elect to fill in the blanks and make the plan more generous than required. We talked about the minimum you have to cover. You can elect to modify the terms of the plan, and as long as those terms are more generous than the required amounts, you can allow the employees to come in the plan under more generous terms. However, those terms must be applied consistently. In his particular plan, he required the employee only be 18 years of age rather than 21 and only have worked one half year out of the previous 5 years rather than three. Now, the opinion doesn't tell us why those options were chosen or what impact they might have had on how contributions should have been allocated or which employees were eligible. However, such modifications may need to be made in SEPs for entities that are just getting started or for which the individuals, the family, wants to cover the kids. Therefore, if we want to cover our 19-year-old son in the SEP plan who's working for the business, we modify the SEP to make the age of entry 18. Similarly, if we just start operation of the business and I've only worked for the business for 1 year, because the business has only been around for 1 year, then I probably want to modify my terms so I don't have to work three years before being able to get a contribution. That wouldn't work too well for me, so I modify my terms. As long as the terms are at least as generous as the minimums required under the law, and as long as they're applied consistently, we can make these changes. Now, the tax court did point out one little detail in the instructions on the form that Mr. Brown executed, noting that the instructions on the form caution the employer, all eligible employees must be allowed to participate in the SEP. Now we come to our mere technicality, or maybe not. The operation of the plan proved to be a bit more difficult than Mr. Brown believed it was, and that's not unusual, frankly, for a lot of SEP plans we see implemented by taxpayers who put the SEP in just because they heard it was nice and simple to do and got it from someplace and now come to you after they've been going for a few years and you look at how the SEP's been operated. But the fact that it wasn't quite as simple to run would work to his disadvantage and his misunderstanding would work to it. In April of 2004, the Browns made a contribution under the SEP of $7,200, Both Mr. and Mrs. Brown worked for the corporation that year. Both were over age 18 and both met the half year in the prior 5 years eligibility test. Mr. Brown had been paid $36,000 while Mrs. Brown had received $18,000. However, when it came time to allocate that contribution, we didn't allocate the contributions 2/3 to Mr. Brown, 1/3 to Mrs. Brown and put those in their IRA accounts. Rather, all of the contribution was put into Mr. Brown's SEP IRA account. Mrs. Brown made a traditional IRA contribution of $3,000 to her own IRA for each of the 2 years involved. Now, the IRS did initially note one problem. They actually claimed the deduction for the SEP contribution not on the front page of the Form 1120S, Employee Benefit, but rather on the front page of Form 1040 as an adjustment to income. The IRS noted that, in fact, to the extent if it would have been allowable deduction, the deduction was technically allowed to the corporation because it's the corporation's plan as a sponsor, and Mr. and Mrs. Brown as employees, the employer pays the contribution and takes the deduction. But the IRS indicated that wasn't the ultimately totally fatal flaw in this arrangement that caused the plan to fail. The IRS did note, though, that the corporation should have deducted it, and what they noted was Section 1366, which provides essentially for separately and non-separately stated income of an S corporation, and the position is that this is an item that is reported on the S corporation's return and passes out to the shareholders. Note, we get a different result here than we would get with a sole proprietor or a partner in a partnership. S corporations, while there are times when we do treat them as if they are self-employed or we treat them as if they were partners in a partnership for certain employee benefits, that is not the way they end up being treated for qualified plans. There we respect the fact that they are an employee of the plan, employee of the entity, and we take the deduction on the corporate return directly. But even ignoring that, the coverage issues was to the IRS the major problem. The IRS argued that the failure to make a contribution for Mrs. Brown caused the plan to violate Section 408K2, and that failure to operate the plan in accordance with the code and its own terms rendered the contribution non-deductible. Now, the taxpayers argued this is simply being unfair. First, they claim this is just a minor technicality. We put $7,200 into the account. It went in for Mr. Brown. We're getting along just fine. You know, love each other. Think it's great. We get along with each other. What's mine's yours. What's yours mine. Who's harmed? What's the big deal here? Well, the tax court didn't agree. It said that disagreed with the contention that the failure of the corporation to contribute to an IRA in favor of an employee was a mere technicality. The requirement aimed at fairness and equitable treatment for employees is one of the few basic provisions of the SEP regime. Note, the tax court is saying here in no uncertain words that the SEP is a simplified, very straightforward, and supposed to be easy to follow employee benefit plan. Because of this, we expect those easy to follow options to be strictly followed, not just followed vaguely or kind of right or we're kind of in the general area, but we expect them to follow these few simple requirements. The court also pointed out that the instructions contained on the form the taxpayer executed point out this little technicality was an important requirement and that there was no reason they shouldn't have been aware. It noted even if the provision could be fairly characterized technicality, it is one that was brought to the attention of the president of the corporation, Mr. Brown, more than once in the agreement. Mr. Brown, as president, signed and agreed the provisions contained in the agreement, including the requirement that each employee receive from the corporation a contribution to his or her IRA. Now, we all know that in the real world, clients tend to not read things, and especially don't read things like IRA adoption agreements. Rather, you almost consider it a miracle they had one. Probably had one only because Vanguard put it in the packet, so they signed one and got it. But certainly they probably didn't read that agreement nor any of the other documents. Nevertheless, the court is holding them to this, probably because in this case, a particular agreement was only 2 pages long. And the court probably came to the conclusion again, because this was meant to be a simplified system, that obviously you have to expect there are some rules. And if they couldn't be bothered to read those 2 pages, then honestly, they're not paying any attention whatsoever, and they're just, you know, adopting this and claiming they should get a tax break on this. And the court was not allowed them to be so flippant with the way they operate. Now, but it does seem interesting that the court seems to have no sympathy here for the do-it-yourselfer mentality in the case. As noted, it's not unusual in the real world for us to find that clients don't read things. They don't read our letters sometimes. They don't read other documents, and they certainly don't read all the little papers that come out that during the year telling them that this is important for tax purposes. We often discover things that clearly said important for tax purposes that the client never gave us. In fact, I find quite often that's when I find out CP2000 notices are in many cases when I first find out a client sold a security because they forgot they did it by the time the year comes around, even though they received the 1099-B. Well, but similarly here, this was a case where the court didn't have sympathy. And a taxpayer that unrelated employees were excluded from the plan, something we sometimes see when the employee, when the owner doesn't meet the 3 of 5 test, but he gets a contribution while his employees don't, would fare far worse, we would expect, than these taxpayers did. The taxpayer did suggest that maybe there should be some slack granted since for other purposes, the spouse and the owner are given rough equivalents. The taxpayer was trying to come under the attribution rules of Section 318. The taxpayer argued that since Section 318 creates a my stock is your stock rule of sorts, it should follow that Mr. Smith's IRA account is equivalent of Mrs. Smith's IRA account. Remember, under Section 318, that's the provision that says we have attribution. And for certain employee benefits, let's talk about the if we had paid for health insurance for Mr. and Mrs. Brown, Mrs. Brown would be considered a more than 2% shareholder, and we would apply the self-employed health insurance rules to any contributions made to a medical plan on her behalf. The tax court, however, pointed out that Section 318 has no relevance as regards SEPs. As the court notes, petitioner's contention in their petition is the Section 318 rules of attribution treat the contribution to Mr. Brown's IRA as a contribution to Mrs. Brown's IRA. The problem with this position is the Section 318 constructive ownership of stock, as the title implies, addresses stock ownership, not IRA or SEP contributions. For example, an individual shall be considered owning the stock owned directly or indirectly by or for his spouse. See Section 318A1AI. In addition, Section 318 applies to those provisions of this subchapter to which the rules contained in this section are expressly made applicable. That's found in Section 318A. Section 318B lists the provisions to which the rules contained in subsection A apply. The court notes that Section 408 is not one of the provisions listed in Section 318B and is not in the same subchapter of the code as Section 318. Having rejected all of the taxpayer's defenses, the deduction for the SEP was disallowed entirely, as the IRS had argued at trial. Now, what's the lesson we need to pick up from this? SEPs present special problems, ones the IRS has been made aware of in the past on a number of studies. One thing to consider immediately is the mere existence of this case indicates that the IRS likely has the issue out in the minds of agents conducting examination of closely held businesses. In essence, if the agents haven't been told to look for this, we usually won't see a case come down the line in the court. In fact, that's always, to me, a good indicator of maybe what agents are looking at or what they've been told to look at in the past couple of years by looking at the types of cases we see, and we now see this SEP case. Whether this becomes a pattern, and like what we saw with self-employed health insurance, we see a number of these SEP cases come down, remains to be seen. But we have to consider, at least for the moment, that may be a possibility, and SEPs may be on the radar of IRS agents examining small plans. Now, SEPs have traditionally been difficult for the IRS to target in a special program because there's no filing requirement for a SEP, and the deduction is reported on the same line as regular qualified plans for the employer. And since agents did not appear to be specially instructed to look at SEP plans in the past, they often seemed to go unchallenged even when a small business with a SEP was examined. agents tended to look at, and even today I believe many agents see a qualified plan, and if they're not a plan agent, they kind of want to pass over that. That's not their area of expertise. It appears, though, that at least someone's now telling them when we see a SEP, we need to look at it. At least one agent in this particular case that the Browns had found that to be the case. Many taxpayers have little or no clue about how a SEP should be operated and often arrive with misinformation they've gathered from various unofficial sources, including their friends, neighbors, any other acquaintance, the newspaper they read, what they read in the magazine, all those neat things, and what they misinterpreted from what they've read in the newspaper and the magazine. For instance, in this case, I doubt it was coincidental that the amount contributed to the plan was 20% of Mr. Smith's earnings, an amount that Mr. Smith likely thought was the maximum coverage contribution available for his wages based on the information he saw on SEP limits for the self-employed. Remember, there the traditional thought is, well, it's 20%, right? No. The limit for a SEP maximum contribution is 25% of covered compensation. For the self-employed, we end up at the 20 because it's 25% of compensation after taking a deduction for the 25% of compensation. And when you work that roundabout math, you end up with effectively a 20% contribution limit. As I note, in reality, for an S corporation, we take the salary times 25%. That's our maximum maximum SEP contribution. As well, quite a few people, and even some practitioners I've run into, believe that the only requirement to set up a SEP is that you have self-employment income. And therefore, if you're a partner in a partnership that passes out self-employment income to you, you can go ahead and set up a SEP on your own account based upon the amounts coming out to you, regardless of the fact that no contribution is being made for any other partner in the partnership, nor is a contribution being made for any other employee. In fact, the partnership has never adopted a SEP. I've unfortunately run into that one more than once in the past, and it seems to be a relatively common misconception. Again, a dangerous one because that is very simple to be thrown out because there is no justification whatsoever for the individual being allowed to set up a SEP account by himself. Rather, SEPs must be established by an employer or the deemed employer in the case of a self-employed person. The self-employed person who is a partner, and because self-employed by virtue of being a partner, the partnership is the entity that has to sponsor the plan. A real risk is that taxpayers who have established these SEPs may assume that the person doing their tax return or their business's attorney would let them know about any issues of this sort that they might be running into, an assumption the attorney, EA, or CPA may not share, especially if that person sees themselves as not a qualified plan specialist. Now, such individuals probably have other clients who make use of qualified plan specialists, and they get the contribution from the third-party administrator, etc., and all of the accounting and all the notice requirements and everything else that has to happen is taken care of by that third-party administrator. And these people have other people walk in who are their small clients who have a SEP contribution, and those individuals then come in and say, well, I've got a SEP contribution, and they make it, and the CPA or the EA or their attorney, when discussing it, just accepts the fact that, oh, well, it must be done right. This is the percentage. The problem is that since you're the only professional in the room, if things go wrong, the only person left around for somebody to look at to try to have deep pockets to fill in for this shortfall in taxes is going to be the CPA, EA, or attorney that they talk to because that's the only professional in the room. There is no third-party administrator who has responsibility or who can be said to have responsibility for maintaining compliance of this plan with the requirements under the code. Well, as I noted, I'm going to be heading to New Orleans in just about a week, actually a week from Monday. I'll be in New Orleans on the 2nd of June. In New Orleans, I'll be doing be meeting with the AICPA's tax division, the Tax Practice Improvement Committee in New Orleans. I'm a member of that committee this year. And so I'll be doing a couple of days there. I hope to get another podcast put together and recorded potentially sometime this week. That will probably go up next weekend. So you may be looking for that. Hopefully I'll get that out to you so we get that done because I don't know. I'm going to have a lot of time to record much while I'm in New Orleans and then I get back and have to finish up the stuff I have to finish up or the stuff that my clients will be giving me when I get back. Plus next week is my week for those of you who are in the States that get the podcast that I do with Lynn Nichols and Mike Mayers. the state society. Some of the state societies have us do one. I'm also in charge this week. This is my week to do that one. So I have a few things on the burner coming up, but we hopefully will get that out to you. So if there are developments that come up during the week and you wonder why I selected the case I did for next week's podcast, it's because I'm getting a little ahead of the game. But this has been the Tax Update Podcast for May the 26th, 2008. The Tax Update is brought to you, as always, by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Be sure to check them out for information on their website of interest to CPAs, EAs, tax attorneys, and others in tax practice. Subscribe to their newsletters. Again, visit them on the web, www.lineberg-services.com. This has been the Tax Update.